I always try to keep the talks very pragmatic. One of the difficulties sometimes with this time of year is the what I'll put charitably as obligatory socialization. It's not as if we don't already have enough of that in our lives if we work, or if there's any time in our life where we have to be around the dreaded other people all the time. There's that form of obligatory socialization. But then there's also gatherings, social gatherings and the like, where we have to do such things as small talk. And even if this time of year didn't have all the additional socialization gatherings and such, in life, just going to places where there are other people that we have to deal with can be very challenging. Other people can be challenging. So, some of the Buddha's tools, most of the Buddha's tools, virtually all of the Buddha's tools are useful in dealing with the challenge of sharing a world with other people. Tonight I'm going to be talking about the Buddha's teachings on Sankhara, which is one of his most important concepts. And I think it gives a lot of tools for dealing with difficult situations in life. Sankharas. So, I was watching a documentary the other day on one of my favorite songwriters, Leonard Cohen, and it was a documentary made in the 60s when he was in his 30s, before he became a songwriter. He was a famous poet in Canada, and it was a documentary from that period of time when he was a poet, and he's on a television show, and the interviewer says, "So what's your agenda? What are you trying to accomplish?" And rather than saying, "Well, I want to write the perfect poem," or whatever, Leonard Cohen says, "I'm actually, when I wake up in the morning, I ask myself if I'm in a state of grace, and then I do whatever I can, if I'm not, to achieve a state of grace." And the interviewer says, "Well, I don't know what a state of grace means." And Leonard Cohen says, I can't say Leonard, it's just too pretentious, so I have to say his full name every time. I wish I knew him. I wish I could say Leonard said, but I just feel that I can't. He's one of those giant figures for me, so I have to. Mr. Cohen says, it's a state of inner peace, where whatever's going on in the world around, I feel that, he says, it's rather arrogant to try to change the world and the people around you to try to get your peace. Rather, he says, I use the image of an errant ski. I guess that's because he's Canadian. An errant ski going down a mountain. It just goes wherever the mountain takes it, but it doesn't, it's not agitated, he says. Another, so this idea that we're finding a peace from within, but how do we do that? One of the old sayings is that old Buddhist sayings is that with fruit, when you buy fruit, you're going to get rind and pits, but you can throw away the rind and the pits and just eat the good parts. But with people, you can't do that. We try. We try to figure out the perfect thing to say that'll get rid of their rinds and their pits, and they stick to it. They don't listen, do they? They keep their rinds and their pits, and we don't even notice, but we keep our rinds and our pits too. So how do we exist in the world with all these irritations? Sankhara is the idea that all the time we are adding on to or elaborating on the very bare sensations that make up our real experience. I'll say that again. It's the part that we are adding on to any given situation. Right now, of course, there are sensations that you're experiencing. There are sights and sounds, aromas, physical sensations. All of that could be referred to, and often is in the commentaries of the Buddhist teachings, as dhammas, the truth, literally. That's what the truth is, the bare sensations before we add on to what's going on. But we do something called sankhara. It's often translated as fabrication. We're fabricating or putting together an entire inner world with a narrative. We're putting together a story of what's going on right here and right now. And there's many different elements to this story. The Buddha said that we elaborate or put together our experience in three ways. We add on. And it's very important to understand this, because this is how we add suffering to our lives. For example, if I stub my toe, there's just the pain in the toe, but if it was just that, it would be so much easier to get through than all the stuff I add on to when I stub my toe. I add thoughts. Holy shit. Look how stupid I am. And who left that over there? And what the fuck is going on? And why are things always in my way? And fuck this, you know? And then there's the focusing on the pain to the exclusion of everything else that's not painful. And then there's the stress that my body feels. Oh, I can't believe this happened. And then there's just the overall physical other sensations of that I'm adding onto it. And the breathing, the way I suddenly start to hyperventilate when I've done something careless. So besides just the bare sensation of the stubbed toe, there's so much suffering that I'm adding on. The Buddha said those are the second arrows. The first arrow is just the pain. And there's going to be inevitable pain from the outside world. People are going to say painful things, do painful things. We're going to say and do painful things, no matter how mindful we try to be. But so much of the suffering is optional. It's the sankharas, the adding on, the putting things on top of the experience that causes the real suffering. Is that sort of clear? Okay. If anything's not clear, you can ask about it. So there's the bare sensations, and then there's three kinds of things we add on. The first is just what the Buddha called kaya sankhara, which is the way we're breathing and holding our body in any situation. Very often when we're going through a difficult situation where we're going to have a conversation at a job or in any interaction with somebody who in the past we've had difficulties or challenges with, or we've experienced some form of struggle with, we'll start to breathe in a very uncomfortable way, and we'll hold our body in a very stressed or rigid way. So we're already creating the undercurrents of disapproval, dislike, suffering, stress, just by the way we're holding the body. That's kaya sankhara. The second of the three is citta sankhara, C-I-T-T-A, citta sankhara. That's the way the mind adds commentary without using words. There's a couple of ways it does that. It's the unconscious basic way that the mind reacts to our experience. It does this by, one, stressing parts of the body. In my case, it's my stomach. When something happens that I don't like, my stomach gets very tight. Sometimes my shoulders start to inch up towards my ears, or my jaw starts to lock. There's infinite ways that people hold their reactions to what's going on in the body. It's often studied in somatic therapy, where we just observe the way people hold the body, and where they not only hold the body, how the body speaks to us. It's basically an unconscious trigger, largely started by a part of the brain called the amygdala, which releases cortisol and then stresses different parts of the body. It's a reaction. It's either a negative reaction, I don't like what the fuck's going on right now, or a very positive one, hey, I really like this. As I've said before, it's very easy to mistake fear for lust, because they often speak in the body in the same way. And many people develop crushes for people that their brains are actually saying, stay away from this person. But their heart starts beating and their chest starts getting tight and they start getting all these symptoms. It's actually fear. But the boys are, oh, they're so dangerous and cool. I really like that. My parents really wouldn't like this one. So that's one form of citta sankhara. The second form is sanna, which is the way we perceive the world. Think of it in terms of, if you've ever watched a movie, not to focus on the stars of the movie, the actors, but to see the way the movie was directed. I don't know if you've ever, if you're into watching movies the way they're directed. Certainly it's fun with Hitchcock films and Polanski films and other films to see, like, how the movie is shot. Does it focus on one character and let everything else dissolve? Or is it a wide frame? Does it shoot from below? Or does it, what kind of lens is the director and cinematographer using? Just as this is done in movies, we edit our lives. We focus sometimes fixatedly on one thing to the exclusion of everything else. I was talking with a friend who had been dumped by a woman, probably smartly, and he went to a social gathering, a party where she was, and he said that he didn't hear a single conversation the entire night because he was just following her around the room. He wasn't stalking her, but he was in his head sort of doing that. He was just fixated on her, and everything else blurred out. So that's the kind of perception that's based on craving. There's also the kind of perception that's based on aversion, where there's somebody we're really scared of, and when they enter a room, we shoot them from below in harsh black and white, grainy film, and, you know, whereas the person we love might have soft focus. That person might be where we see every little detail on their face and their expression, and they're scary. So we look at the things we like and don't like in different ways. We sort of focus and highlight and foreground, and everything else becomes a blurred background. That's how we add sanna, or perceptual filtering, to our lives. It generally boils down to we either like something or we don't like it, but we change the way we look at it and perceive it than we look at anybody else. The most important way, though, of course, is the third group, vachi, vachi sankhara, which is the words we add in our minds, the underlying dialogue, the voiceover, as I call it. Not only is there a way we're directing this film called Our Lives, this documentary we're making about our extraordinary challenges, but in our documentary there's a voiceover. It's called Our Thoughts. You might have heard it before. It's those running voices in your head that's telling you what's good, what's bad, what you like, what sucks, what should happen, what shouldn't happen, all the commentary. That's your voiceover. The Buddha referred to it, when it's skillful, as vitaka and vikara, which means directed thought and evaluation. But most often, he said, it turns into something else. Papancha. Papancha is when the voice becomes, it means literally proliferation or just multiplying thought after thought after thought. That's when our thoughts spin out of control and we start adding an entire little world in our minds. And eventually those papancha, those words, turn into an entire world where we stop even becoming aware of any of the real base sensations and we start fantasizing and creating images that aren't even there. And this is called becoming. Bala. We're literally becoming, creating something new. And that new thing we're creating, this internal world, is called aloka. L-O-K-H-A. It's an entirely made up, fabricated world. So we go from being aware of what's really happening around us to adding all these underlying commentary, vitaka, vikara, which turns into papancha, multiplying thoughts and thoughts and thoughts and thoughts until we start creating a fantasy in our head, a loka. You get it? So we start with what's real and then we start adding commentary and commentary until we float away in a fantasy of how bad it's going to get or how good it could possibly become. We go from the real to the unreal. So, that's sankhara, the three forms of sankhara. It would be tempting to say that the point of all spiritual practice is just to jump from adding on to the world to just experiencing the world without any sankhara, because the sankhara is where most of the suffering comes in. Good luck. That's not the way it works. The Buddha did not teach, oh, by the way, you've been spending your entire life in this craving or aversion-driven way of adding on to your experience, adding thoughts, adding physical sensations, holding your body, breathing in certain ways, perceiving it in a highlighted way. He didn't say, okay, just throw that all away. Go back to scratch like you're a baby in the cradle. That's not what he taught. He said, in fact, during meditation and mindfulness, what we're supposed to do is focus on one part of our experience and notice, one, how we're creating or elaborating or sankhara-ing, and then, B, do it skillfully rather than in a way that causes suffering. What this means is that, for example, suppose you're watching your body during a meeting. You could be focusing on what's going on in the meeting, but you could also just see how your body reacts to the different things that people are saying around you. You might notice that when there's somebody that you don't like talking, that your stomach gets tight, or your chest gets tight, your throat gets tight. There's some underlying physical reaction. The thing to do when you see that you're in the process of sankhara is then to relax whatever area you're stressing out, so that you're, instead of adding unskillful or stress or suffering, you're easing, you're catching yourself and you're relaxing the body. Or you could notice the way you tend to hyper-perceive or focus on somebody and instead, again, relax the awareness and bring in all the other sensations that are going on around you. You could notice, and here's the big one, the big two are the breath and the thoughts. You can notice the way you're breathing in any situation and just relax it, make it as slow and even and as unstressful a breath as possible. But the biggest thing that I work on besides relaxing the breath and the body is noticing what the thoughts I'm adding and skillfully changing the thoughts from stressful thoughts that cause suffering to thoughts that don't. The Buddha came up with a list of skillful thoughts to think when someone is causing us suffering. Wouldn't you like to know what it is, but it'll cost you $20. No, I'm going to give it to you for free. It's only on TV where they lead you up to, and we've got the answer for $19.95 to send away. And not only if you do that, I'll also give you another sutta for free. No, it's all free. It's all there for you. You can find it all in Access to Insight. I'm going to give you, it's from a wonderful sutta, the Agata Vinaya. It's always one of my favorite suttas that have the most unpronounceable names, the Agata Vinaya, but it's five ways of dealing with people that are making us fucking miserable. It's not what the actual translation is, but it's my translation and I'm happy with it. So, when we notice that we're thinking really angry, resentful thoughts, here are the five things to ponder or reflect to relax and be skillful in the way we're adding sankhara. The first is to try to send them goodwill, which is just as when we were doing in the meditation, is to wish that they'd find happiness for themselves in a skillful place. By not trying to control or acting unskillfully with other people, but in fact, you're wishing that they would try to find more peace from within. You're not rewarding them for being an asshole. You're simply saying, may they find their peace from within. Just that little change, though, from, boy, I hate this person, to, boy, I wish they'd find happiness within, is a pretty amazing transition. It's still, there's still a level of self-interest in it, and there's nothing wrong with that. You're hoping that they're going to find peace so that they don't cause suffering for everyone around them, and also so that they feel better. It's a no-lose situation, folks. So I say, consider it. The second is karuna. The first was metta, the second is karuna, which means to wish or try to find compassion for them. When people are acting unskillfully around us, it's because they are suffering. I guarantee it. Nobody acts in a really, really awful way to another human being unless inside they are stressed out. When people are happy and at peace within, they do not make other beings suffer. So if you're around somebody who is trampling all over the people who are around them, feeling compassion rather than coming at them from a place of aversion will at least make your experience different. Now, I'm not saying when somebody is really unskillful or violent or breaking every single limit that they should to stay around them. I'm just talking about your thoughts about them. By all means, get to a safe place. Get away from them if they're causing that much damage. But when you then think about them, when you're in a safe place, try to cultivate a little bit of compassion, being aware that this person must be really, really, really suffering. Now, if you can't do that, don't worry. There's five. You don't have to do all five of them. You could say that compassion thing, stretching it a little far. Buddha was a better man than I. I'm not going to think compassionate thoughts. That's all right. You can always put that off to the future. Believe me, there's lots of people in my life I've put off compassion towards in the future. He used to be a vice president, in fact. Upeka is the third. That means balance. When we're really angry with someone or we're displeased with them, we tend to really focus on what they're saying. We tend to hyper-focus on them, in fact. Upeka means to try to focus on other people. Duh. It sounds really obvious, but it's really amazing how when there's one person at a gathering that my mind says, oh, this person, they never really liked me that much. I'm going to try to make them really like me. What would make them really like me? My brain can still be like that. Instead of trying to throw all this thought into a lost cause, equanimity, upeka, means to look at all the other people around and put our energy into them. recognize when somebody is just not going to respond and move on. That's what upekkha or balance means. It's about not giving up on humanity. It's about finding the people that we can engage with in a positive way and give up on the ones that we've tried and it's just not going to work out. And very often, for some reason, due to our past or their past or whatever, it's just never going to work out. And we have to recognize when that's the case and put our efforts into fostering relationships and friendships with people that will respond. The Buddha also talked about reflecting on karma, which is when people act like a shit, they have to live in the results. There's nothing we have to do to punish them. Nobody gets away with anything. It might seem like it because we're not in their minds. But when people act through anger or act out their stress, all they're doing is recreating more stress for themselves and more anger for themselves, and that's really an unfun mind to be in. When somebody acts in a really stressed out way and takes that on another people, all they are doing is keeping the karmic circle of karma going, of unskillfulness going, samsara. And then finally, of course, the Buddha also counseled the most difficult, which is ignoring them. If all else fails, just ignore them. Recognize that this person is just not going to work out with us. What they're saying, what they're doing is just unskillful, and just pay them no heed. Treat them like they're the insane person on the street that you just keep on walking. Now, sometimes when we're in a meeting, we can't do that. So I found that when I'm stuck in a situation with somebody that I feel I really can't deal with, I might go back to the body, I might go to the breath, I might focus on other people, I might think thoughts about how I can say something to someone else that might be positive, or I might just reflect on how this person is really suffering and how it's a waste of time for me to add any more thought to them because they're already going to have to bear the brunt of all this. Now, the long-term goal, getting back to the overall agenda, is when we pay enough attention to how we're adding on stress in our lives by focusing on how we're stressing the body, the breath, perception, thoughts, eventually, very, very slowly over time, we'll begin, as we focus on one thing at a time, we'll begin to slowly let go. We'll catch ourselves adding on commentary. We'll catch the body getting stressed out. We'll catch the breath changing. We'll catch the mind generating thoughts and creating thought worlds. And each time it'll be easier to go back to just the pure basic sensations. It's not a surprise that the Buddha referred to enlightenment as made up of a state called neither perception nor non-perception. What he meant for that by that is an agendaless way of perceiving the world. We're no longer approaching it through craving, ignorance, or aversion. We're just there, but we've got all the inner sources for peace at our disposal, so we no longer have to feel so vulnerable at the whims of other people. So that's sankhara. Next week I'm going to be talking, I think, about the exact opposite. I'm going to be talking about, not of sankhara, but of dealing with isolation. So I hope you'll come, and I hope you'll come on Thursday to share more. And now's your chance to ask any questions about tonight's talk. And I hope you got something from it.
Just a quick announcement. I'm going to be sending out an update, like an email about Thursday night classes and whatnot. If you want to get on the email list, come and see me.
Also, you can Facebook me, Josh Korda, and I'll get you on the list too if you want.
That's even easier. Facebook.
Yeah. Do you have a question? So, thoughts, questions? Anything? Hi.
Thank you, Josh. Is that something you really like, the Buddhist idea about great doubt? You know, like doubting. That refers to doubting kind of things, these ego-based stories that we tell ourselves.
Yeah, well, doubt is like, there's two forms of doubt. There's skillful doubt and there's unskillful doubt, the Buddha taught. There's the skillful doubt is exactly what you're talking about, which is beginning to, once you start experiencing how much the mind distorts reality, and that distortion is always there, you start to mistrust the underlying thoughts, physical sensations, gut feelings, everything. You don't take anything as real or true. You start to question everything that your mind is adding onto life. And for at the beginning, we should really assume that that's basically everything. I mean, the true, real sensations, the dhammas, are so embroidered already by the way we perceive them, edit them, comment on them, all that, that it's very, very difficult to even know where the real ends and the elaboration begins. So that's very skillful doubt. And the Buddha said another form of doubt besides that is also doubting any spiritual tool until you see that it works for yourself. The only thing he said to believe in or have faith in is karma, which means that if we act unskillfully, we will at some time later on pay for it. And if we act skillfully, we will at some future later date find ourselves feeling the better for it. That's the only thing he said to trust him on. For the rest, he said to doubt. So the only area where the Buddha said to have real faith is that if you act skillfully, your mind in the long term will be the better for it. But everything else, especially doubting one's thoughts, is the, I would say, is the hallmark of advanced spirituality, along with doubting the gut feelings. Very often people say, trust your gut. I would say the opposite, which is not to do exactly the opposite of what your gut says, but a lot of times what our gut wants us to do is not the skillful thing. The thing to trust is what in our past has led to lasting happiness. Reflect on that. In the past, when I've shown up or dealt with a difficult thing or, you know, worked through a challenge or a breakdown in a relationship, if I work through those things, they're never fun in the short term. But in the long term, they've led to lasting peace. So reflect, what are the actions in the past I've seen that have worked for me? And do those. Don't trust what the brain tells you to do first. In my case, the first thing my mind's always going to tell me to do is the most frightened, scaredy cat thing. After many, many years of spiritual practice and sobriety, that's what my brain is good for in the first take. When I'm in a new challenge, the first thing it says is, run, hide, lie, escape. So I've learned to not trust anything, and to then, instead of just doing what is the first suggestion, to doubt it, doubt everything, and ask myself time and time again, wait, what has my past shown me is the skillful thing to do? What have I seen wise spiritual practitioners, people I admire, what do they do in this situation? Stuff like that. Is that sort of an answer?
Yeah. In response to what you said, something about meditation that quiets my mind that makes me think that I am able to have a sense of intuition. You know, it's an intuition that I can trust. As opposed to before, I was baffled. My mind could concentrate with all these spiritual thoughts going on. And after meditating or, you know, religious kind of don't even think, but just somebody says, do you want to be in this relationship? I'd be like, yeah. It seems like something.
Yeah, a good thing to ask is ask if, when you get any advice from your mind, ask if it's something that you would say to someone else in the same situation. Because generally, we're much more compassionate towards others, and we hold ourselves to bizarre standards that we would never hold, or we're not as compassionate with ourselves as we are with other people. Hi.
Hi.
Oh.
I mean, in a way, I guess I realized that, the question is, don't you think in a way, too, though, if there's a buildup of, you know, if you're doing skillful things for on and off the years, like before you started your practice, let's say you had...